The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. And standing up to the badness, Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman and co-author, investigative journalist, contributing writer to Mother Jones and brother David Goodman, argue that everyday people who fight for the beliefs wield the greatest power in the United States. Through profiles of citizens who rose to extraordinary challenges, like the four Connecticut librarians who refused to spy on their patrons, challenged the Patriot Act, and won, we especially like them. The Goodmans emphasize how any individual can take action and effect change. I'm proud to say we've had Amy for the last couple of books, and we're very pleased that David is finally joining us. Please welcome David Goodman.
Well, it's great to be here with you at the Philadelphia Free Library. And you'll hear why in a moment. I have a particular affection for this place and others like it. Our new book, Standing Up to the Madness, is the third book that my sister and I have written. It amazes me because we did this over the objections of our mother, who insisted that it was more important to be brother and sister than to be co-author 5 years ago. But I'm happy to report we are still talking and I love my sister. So, but this book is really an outgrowth of the tours that we took with our previous books. We wrote Exception to the Rulers in 2004, Static in 2006. And in the course of what have been sort of madcap dashes across the country, we did just about a 100-city tour for our last book. This book we have just finished about 50 cities. We're not just talking, we're also listening, and we're hearing amazing stories, and they are both amazing and inspiring stories of resistance all across the country. The ways that people have spoken up and taken courageous stands in their communities, in the variety of crackdowns that have occurred in the wake of 9/11, the policies that have been spawned where our government now supports. I mean, it's incredible that we are speaking today about a government with an official policy of torture, one of the most notorious torture colonies in the world in Guantanamo Bay. And people have been standing up to this. This has not been let to pass. And it's people been standing up because our leaders have failed to lead. And so ordinary citizens are the ones who have picked up this fallen torch of democracy. But so we have met a lot of people, but I have to tell you, you can't always pick the people that you meet. As I discovered when I began this tour about a month ago, I was flying out to Seattle to start, and I have a terrible habit. I am incorrigible in that. I am always looking for ways to save money, or now I dress it up and I say I'm trying to reduce my carbon footprint. But when I got out at the airport, one of the ways that I save money is I think it's ridiculous that we all take taxis to the same place from the airport. So I see a guy standing at the taxi line, and he's got this huge suitcase. And as he's hefting this into the car, I overheard him saying that he was going right where I was going, downtown Seattle. So I took advantage of him, I guess, and threw my bag in the back as he was struggling with his suitcase and hopped in the back seat and said, "Do you mind if I share the ride with you?" And he responded in a British accent that, yes, that would be okay. He looked a little surprised. But when I heard that British accent, I knew I had him, because if he even said a word, I'd just turn him into immigration and he'd go right to Guantanamo. And so, you know, the chit-chat turned to, we had a half-hour ride, and I said, so what do you do? He says, "I'm a defense contractor." "Oh, really? And what part of the business are you in?" And he said, "Surveillance." So I asked the obvious question, "How's business?" "Never been better," he assured me. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I just was attending a conference in Ottawa where myself and a number of other defense contractors. And I sort of blurted out without thinking, oh, you mean an arms bazaar? And he got very quiet at that point. And he said, yes, and I'm one of the merchants of death who the protesters were shouting at every morning. So he then, I said, what do you do at these conferences? And he said, well, we talk about terrorism, the rising threat of terrorism, new tactics they're deploying, new technologies we can utilize against them. It's pretty much terrorism, 24/7. And I said, really, do you believe that stuff? And he just broke into a smile, and he says, pure rubbish. And I said, well, what do you think is going on with terrorism? He says, oh, I just think a lot of politicians are using terrorism as a cover to ram through policies that they can't get through in regular times. He says, and mostly we're just making a hell of a lot of money. Well, now I got spooked because I'm thinking, our book isn't even out yet, but clearly he has read it. And knowing the line of work he's in, I'm thinking, absolutely, he's read this thing. And then, of course, he turns to me and he says, what do you do? And at that point, I very sheepishly push my book across the seat towards him, and he looks at it, and he accuses me then of trying to put him out of business, which I said I would never want to do in the course of this taxi ride. Well, finally, we get to our destination, and he's lifting his suitcase out, and now I know that it must be bristling with electronic eavesdropping equipment. And I reach into my wallet to share the cab fare, and he waves me off and says, reaches into his pocket and pulls out a big fat wad of bills, you know, like most defense contractors usually have in their pocket. And he peels off a few bills and hands the entire fare to the cabbie and then wheels around and turns to me and says, now don't ever say that the defense industry hasn't done something for you. So in the interest of full disclosure, I come to you bought and paid for by a British spy company here today. Well, I want to tell you, we tell a lot of stories in this book, stories of people who are mostly unknown. They range from soldiers of conscience who have stood up against a war they consider to be illegal and immoral, scientists who are speaking out against censorship about climate science, a number of people, as we call them in the chapter, T is for terrorists. These are, of course, some of the most dangerous people, the people who wear T-shirts with political slogans, many of whom have been arrested. But my favorite story is the one that we tell about the people who have to rate as some of the most fearless, tenacious, and amazing freedom fighters in our country. These are people you would not want to meet in a dark alley if you were trying to hijack somebody's civil liberties. And, of course, I could be speaking of no one else than our nation's librarians. Are there any librarians in the house here in the library? Oh, okay. I just need to know what kind of rough company. Well, our story takes place in Connecticut, where 27 libraries near Hartford have their computer systems linked together and managed by a small cooperative nonprofit called the Library Connection. And one day, the Library Connection is run by volunteer librarians from the 27 libraries and a small professional staff. And you know, computers are a big use of public libraries today. People go to check their email, surf the web. They go to learn how to use computers. So one day, the director of the Library Connection, a man named George Christian, answers a knock at the door. And it's some people who want to see the boss. And he's thinking, oh, boy, some other people who think that we're the library and I have to direct them to the library. We're just the computer outfit. But no, these were two FBI special agents from the Hartford office, and they came bearing a letter, but this was no ordinary letter. It was a National Security Letter, or NSL, And to be handed one of these is sort of like being handed a radioactive rock. Because once you're exposed, you are bound by its contents and gagged. And so they instructed him to open the letter and read it in front of them. It was very brief. It explained that they wanted identifying information on every single user of the all 27 public libraries on a particular day 4 months earlier, when there was one email that they wanted to know a little more about. And in order to do that, they wanted information on all the library patrons. And then the agent reached over with his finger and highlighted a couple of lines in particular, highlighted it in the way that, you know, the children's librarian does during story hour when she wants to show that, make sure the kids are understanding. It was the lines that said, "You can tell no one about this investigation or that you have been visited by the FBI. This is an investigation under the USA Patriot Act. If you tell anyone that you are under investigation, you are breaking a gag order and subject to 5 years in jail." So George Christian peers up over his bifocals and looks at them and he says, "I believe this is unconstitutional and I'm not going to give you anything." So the FBI agents look at him in the way that a predator looks at its prey, that kind of pitying way, like you have no idea what is about to happen to you. And they reach into their pockets and they give him a business card and they just said, "I suggest you call us immediately when you're ready to talk." They leave. George Christian slinks back into his office after his little 5 minutes playing Superman and collapses in his chair and thinks, "What on earth am I going to do now? I am committing myself to taking on the entire national security state of post-9/11 America." And he thinks for a minute and he thinks, "Well, if I'm going to do this right, I'm going to need at least three other librarians to do it just the way it ought to be done." So he makes a phone call to Peter Chase, the director of the Plainville Public Library, and he says, Peter's one of three librarians who sit on the executive committee. He says, "Peter, we are going to have an emergency meeting of the executive committee of the Library Connection tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. You have to be there. You can tell no one why you're going or where you're going. Just be there, and you might want to clear your calendar for the next month or so." So Peter thinks, "Well, okay," gets off the phone, and as he's driving there the next morning, he suddenly occurs to him, an emergency meeting of the Library Connection? What could we be talking about? Overdue books? Perhaps an adult book misfiled in the children's section? Or maybe it's another Catcher in the Rye complaint. Well, when he gets there, along with two other librarians, George Christian pulls out this letter, thereby exposing him to the radioactivity that's inside. Everyone in the room is now bound and gagged by its provisions. And so we pick it up from there in the book. Few Americans understand how draconian the Patriot Act is unless it reaches out and touches them. When the four Connecticut librarians received a national security letter, they were shocked to learn that it stripped away civil rights that they thought were inviolable. "Where's the court order?" Chase asked George Christian. "There is none," replied Christian. "They said they didn't need one because they had an NSL. The librarians were being ordered to turn over records on their patrons simply because an FBI agent told them to." It's the equivalent of the corner cop being given the full power and authority of what previously had been reserved to the courts to do. An FBI agent is really just the federal equivalent of a corner cop. As Peter Chase explained to us, "For us, this is a very important principle. A court order protects you because you have a neutral third party, the court, and you must convince them that a crime has been committed. People come to us and say very confidential things to our reference librarians. They have medical issues, personal matters. What people are borrowing at a public library is nobody's business. It turns out that for librarians, safeguarding the privacy of their patrons is something they consider to be a sacred trust. And for Connecticut's mild-mannered librarians, there was no hesitation about how they would respond to this attack on the privacy of their patrons. They would fight like hell." And so the battle unfolded. The their local nonprofit attorney basically fled the room when the NSL was pulled out and said, "This is way over my head. You better call the ACLU." So the ACLU got involved because actually it turns out that the people known as our nation's shushers have a few more things up their sleeve. They have been itching for a fight to take on the Patriot Act, which specifically targets librarians in several of its sections. The ACLU attorneys explained to the librarians that in order to challenge this gag order and to challenge their authority to demand information from a library, you will have to sue the Attorney General of the United States. Now, librarians are very familiar with the Attorney General of the U.S. That would be John Ashcroft, the man who referred to librarians as a bunch of hysterics for suggesting that the federal government might be interested in what's going on in libraries. That would be Michael Mukasey, the current Attorney General, the man who has referred to librarians as dupes of the administration's opponents for suggesting that the FBI had nothing better to do than snoop on, book lovers. Yes, they knew all about the Attorney General, and they said, "Well, that would be fine. We'd love to sue the Attorney General of the United States, but we'd like to take it a step farther. If we're going to go into a fight with them, we'd like to take the whole Patriot down with us." So they are looking forward to their day in court. You might remember from sixth grade social studies that's something that was guaranteed in the Bill of Rights a few hundred years ago. But shortly before their trial was to begin, it was to be held in the federal court in Bridgeport, Connecticut, the lawyers called to let them know that the Justice Department had branded them a threat to national security. They would not be allowed in the courtroom. Instead, Connecticut's America's foremost dangerous terrorists were required to watch their own trial while locked in a secure closet in a federal courthouse 2 hours away in Hartford, where it would be broadcast to them by closed-circuit TV. Now, the librarians described to us that the security guard at the Hartford courthouse was a little mystified about why he was locking librarians in the closet and ordered to guard them, place them under armed guard. But, you know, there's a lot of dangerous people running around, and, it might just make sense that these people who masquerade as reference librarians and children's librarians really had something else going on up their sleeve. So the view that they had of the courtroom is the view that I have of you. The camera was over the shoulder of the judge and looked out on the audience. They saw two things. First, they saw the United States Attorney for Connecticut, Kevin O'Connor, a man who Peter Chase, one of our librarians, had debated all around the state of Connecticut because Peter is the chair of the Intellectual Freedom Committee of the Connecticut Library Association and had debated O'Connor on the Patriot Act, where O'Connor went around the state saying, "Of course we're not interested in libraries. Of course we don't spy on librarians and their customers." So here was the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut making the legal argument in the courtroom about how the front lines of the war on terror had moved to the reference section. They also saw something else in that room. The courtroom was packed with librarians from all around Connecticut. Now, this was a crowd you didn't want to mess with. It was a sign that the troops had come and help was on the way and they would not be fighting this battle alone. Well, they won a round and quickly lost a round. The government upheld many of their arguments, but the government appealed, slapped the gag order back on them. In the course of this, the judge ordered that more information be released about this. The government blew it and released the name of Peter Chase and the library connection. So suddenly, the people who had been, branded, as dangerous as Osama bin Laden had now been, their identity was blown. Well, the case proceeded to court in Manhattan, And the attorneys told them, well, there's good news. First, you can attend your own trial now. But there were a few conditions. First of all, they could not enter the courthouse together, lest anybody realize that they were indeed the Fantastic Four from Connecticut. They also would be going into a courtroom where the lawyers explained, you cannot look at us in the courtroom because nobody should know that you are the people we're talking about up there. And then the lawyers tried to break this a little delicately to them. They said, now, because no one can suspect your identity, could you please not look like librarians? They didn't quite know what to make of that. Peter Chase told us that he decided to put on the black suit that he reserves for funerals because the lawyers very helpfully suggested, why don't you try to look like lawyers? You know, there's a lot of them around courthouses. So he said he tried his best to look dour and grim the whole time instead of like the proud, doting parent that he looks like when he's walking around his library showing people where they can get the books that they want. They were also told that somewhere in that courtroom would be John Doe, New York. The librarians, upon launching this fight, they could not be identified, well, except the government had done that for them. They had lost their name and their voice. They were identified only as John Doe, Connecticut. John Doe, New York would also be in the room. This was a small internet service provider who was also fighting a gag order, refusing to divulge information on his patrons. To this day, John Doe, Connecticut and John Doe, New York do not know who one another are, and yet their cases were joined. They became co-plaintiffs in this effort to take down this entire provision of the Patriot Act. So, Wilf, what is really going on here? Why are librarians in the dock? Well, the real answer is that in the fall of 2005, the Patriot Act was being debated in Congress, and the supporters of the Patriot Act were saying things like, well, I'll quote the then chair of the House Judiciary Committee, James Sensenbrenner, who wrote an op-ed piece in USA Today, which began this way, zero, that's how many civil liberties violations have occurred under the USA Patriot Act. Well, the librarians thought had a different story to tell, and they thought Congress would want to hear it in the course of this this discussion. That's why they were considered a threat, but they were not a threat to national security, of course. They were a threat to the political survival of the Bush administration and its signature anti-terrorism law. That's why they could not speak. We fast forward spring of 2006. The Patriot Act, Congress votes to reauthorize the Patriot Act with very minor changes. 6 weeks later, the librarians in Connecticut receive another letter, this one not so radioactive. It says the government is dropping the case against them. And so a case that everyone assumed would go to the Supreme Court and probably result in a major part of the USA Patriot Act being found unconstitutional suddenly went away, but not all of it. They let stand John Doe, New York's case, who is still gagged. John Doe, New York, his case was decided in September, and this was the case that the librarians had fought for. It ruled as illegal the entire national security letter provision of the Patriot Act that gave the police these authorities previously limited only to courts. So our librarians have gone on to become rock stars, but mostly to other librarians. And we are very happy to share their story far and wide so that now the next time you go into a library and you think of maybe keeping a book out too late or you'll think otherwise when you realize who it is you're dealing with on the other side of the counter. Well, on that note, I bring to you somebody who has been standing up to the madness for over 12 years. That's how long Democracy Now! Has been on the air, my amazing sister, Amy.
Thank you. It is such an honor to be here, so wonderful to be at a book festival, and thank you so much to David, without whom this book would never have been written. Standing up to the madness, what we all have to do this year, this absolutely critical year that could be a turning point not only for people in this country, but for people all over the world. Years ago, I interviewed a woman from Guyana about globalization. And when we finished with our conversation, we were shifting gears and guests to the U.S. elections. And I was ushering her out, bringing the other guests in, and she just sat there. And I said, "We're done with the segment. Thank you so much. And should I be a guest on your next segment?" And I said, "Why?" "It's on the U.S. elections." She was from Guyana. And she said, "Because I believe everyone in the world should get to vote for president of the United States." It's such an interesting point. Well, she doesn't get to vote, and you do. It is an awesome responsibility to come from the most powerful country on earth. What you do matters not just for your family or community or your state. It matters for people everywhere. And it also matters that we have a media to be able to engage in a global conversation about the key issues of the day. Because the media are the most powerful institutions on earth, more powerful than any bomb, than any missile. And the Pentagon's deployed the media, and we have to take it back. It's not good for the generals. It's not good for the low-level soldiers. It is not good for a democratic society. Standing up to the madness, ordinary heroes in extraordinary times, is about ordinary people, though no one is ordinary, who stand up when trouble comes to them. And these are the people who are not heard on the networks. Right, the networks bring you that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We need a media that tells the truth, or I should say the truths, the different experiences of people, and in bringing out those voices, by letting us each hear each other, we support a media that builds bridges, not advocates the bombing of bridges. We tell the stories of many in this book. David talked about the librarians. And then there are the soldiers who have said no, like Lieutenant Aaron Watada, first officer to say no to deployment to Iraq, refused to bring young men and women to lead them into what he called an immoral war. And Augustine Aguayo, he is the Army medic from the Los Angeles area, Army, Mexican-American, who realized in his basic training he couldn't kill anyone. He was sent to Iraq. He applied for CO status, conscientious objector status. His evaluating officer said, "This guy's the real deal. He should get it." He was denied. He refused to load his gun for a year in Iraq the whole time he served, no matter how dangerous the situation was, because he knew he couldn't kill anyone. When he left Iraq, he went back to base in Germany to his wife and two 11-year-old twin daughters, and the military came and said, "You're going right back." He jumped out the window. He went AWOL, as thousands upon thousands upon thousands of soldiers have, according to the Pentagon's own statistics. They just don't like to tell that story. And I interviewed him in Los Angeles on Democracy Now! The day before he turned himself in at Fort Irwin, said he didn't care what happened to him. He just knew he couldn't kill anyone, that would be the worst fate of all for him. These are remarkable people. David and I, as we travel the country, highlight the people in their communities that we have written about. We were just in Boston and Jamaica Plain, and Liam Madden joined us, another of the young soldiers we wrote about. Liam and Jonathan Hutton are two soldiers who active duty led the appeal for redress, their constitutional right, their right to appeal to Congress to bring the soldiers home, a direct appeal from active duty soldiers. And I wouldn't want to go on without acknowledging Al Sapala here today. Al, if you could stand up, who I first met. I first met Al here at the Philadelphia Library. Al's son, Sherwood Baker, died in Iraq, and Al, together with his wife, is the stepmother of Sherwood Baker and Celeste Sapala, the mother of Sherwood Baker, have continued to remind us of the true cost of war. And thank you so much for your service, Al Sapala. I can't think of an example of why we need independent media more than the Winter Soldier hearings that just took place in Silver Spring at the National Labor College just outside of Washington, D.C. How many of you heard or watched the Winter Soldier hearings on Democracy Now? Do you listen on WYBE or watch on WYBE? We're broadcasting on PBS here in Philadelphia. I think the time has been changed to 5 o'clock every day. Is that right? It was at 7, and it's at 6 o'clock every day, and I hope people tune in. If you, unless you're watching every morning on DUTV, is that channel 54 at 8 o'clock in the morning every day? And on Comcast channel 3. We need independent media in a time of war. When we went to cover the Winter Soldier hearing in Silver Spring, I thought we were going to be crowded out by the mainstream media, because this is, I mean, what every journalist looks for. You've got this gathering of veterans, of soldiers who've just come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. You look for people like this for years who are willing to tell their own stories. Some have been involved in atrocities that they describe. They've got the documentary evidence, video, and photograph. I mean, this is what every journalist wants to cover, and none of the reporters came. There were hundreds of soldiers, active duty, and veterans there to tell their stories. Well, Democracy Now! Was there. Pacifica Radio was there. Free Speech TV was there. And it was a remarkable gathering. By the way, I'm writing a column in weekly column, and anyone who wants to see it in the Philadelphia Inquirer or your local paper can just ask. It's distributed by King Features, and a lot of what I've been doing lately has been based on the work that David and I, the book Standing Up to the Madness that we've done, a lot of the stories. Winter Soldier Marches, again, was on the 5th anniversary of the invasion. The idea is to get into mainstream newspapers a roadmap for people to find an arrow to this world of independent voices, to open a whole new universe to people across the political spectrum, because people are united right now, I think, whether conservative, Republican, progressive, Democrat, independent. I think President Bush has managed to unite everyone against him. But Winter Soldier comes from a similar event in 1971 when hundreds of Vietnam vets gathered in Detroit, packed into a Howard Johnson's, derived from the opening line of Thomas Paine's pamphlet, The Crisis, published in 1776. Those searing words, "These are the times that try men's souls." The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country, but he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Well, this Winter Soldier was organized by Iraq Vets Against the War. Its head, Kelly Daugherty, she's the executive director. She opened the proceedings by saying, "The voices of veterans and service members as well as civilians on the ground need to be heard by the American people and by the people of the world, also by other people in the military, other vets, so they can find their voice to tell their story. Because each of our individual stories is crucially important and needs to be heard if people are to understand the true reality, the true human cost of war and occupation, the true cost." You know, Linda Bilmes and Joe Stiglitz's new book, he's the Nobel economist, she's the Harvard economist, The $3 trillion War, $3 $3 trillion. $3 trillion spent on Iraq, not to be confused with for Iraq, and mainly the cost of taking care of the lucky ones, the wounded warriors who come home for the rest of their lives. You know, 1 million servicemen and women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Over 1 million, it's estimated, a third suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. A third? Can you imagine the violence that's rippling through their families, through their communities, through this country? They need to be taken care of, not to mention those who are physically wounded. And how many of you have seen Phil Donahue, Ellen Spiro's Body of War? I encourage you to see it, to bring it to Philadelphia, to the more these films are watched and seen, the more theaters will look for these kind of films. We must see the images. It's the story of a young man named Thomas Young, who on April 4th, 2004 in Sadr City was wounded from the chest down. He was paralyzed, comes back to this country, joins Iraq Veterans Against the War. Amazing. To watch him travel this country in his wheelchair, barely making it in Brooklyn. He speaks. He comes hours late. This is in the film. He puts his head down in his lap, tries to speak, and then is feeling dizzy. And then he gets too hot under the lights. He's got dry ice that's packed all around his body. He can't regulate his temperature anymore. Finally, when he finds his words, he says, "I want to ask you to excuse me if I stutter or say, he says, "Forgive me for sounding presidential." And then he meets with Robert Byrd, the great senator from West Virginia, who's now cast more votes than anyone in the history of the Senate. 18,000 votes. He says his proudest vote was October 2002. Along with 22 others, he led them in his vote against the war. And the film is punctuated by these votes. You know, John Edwards, yay for war. John Kerry, yay for war. Hillary Clinton, yay for war. And so many of the other senators. And there was West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd on the floor of the Senate holding up the Constitution in his shaky hand saying, "Wait!" And leading the charge against war. He sits in his office with young Thomas Young, this wounded soldier, and he takes out a framed copy of the 23 names, what Senator Byrd calls the honor roll of senators who voted no. He has trouble even reading some of the names, and Thomas helps him. And at the end, Senator Byrd turns to Thomas and he says, "Thank you for your service, sir." And Thomas swivels in his wheelchair and he says, "Thank you for your service, sir." Watch Body of War and defy the Washington Post that said people aren't interested in war films, Iraq war films anymore. As long as the war is going on, we should be aware of it every day. I think the testimony of these winter soldiers brought it home so vividly. You had John Michael Turner. David and I met him in Vermont at a movie theater. It was a human rights film festival. And John was clearly in a lot of pain. He was the one who told us about the Winter Soldier hearing, saying he was going to testify. This was at the beginning of the year in March. And he did. He stood before this gathering of soldiers, young and old. It was the Vietnam vets who surrounded the hall of these younger soldiers to protect these soldiers so they could tell their stories. John Michael Turner fought with the 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines. At the end of his testimony, he tore the medals off his chest. He said, "On April 18, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. The man was innocent. I don't know his name. I called him the Fat Man." He said he was walking back to his house. "I shot him in front of his friend and father. The first round didn't kill him. Afterward, he started screaming, looked right in my eyes. So I looked at my friend who I was on post with and said, 'Well, I can't let that happen.' So I took another shot and took him out. He was then carried away by the rest of his family. It took 7 people to carry his body away." John Michael Turner went on, "We were all congratulated after we had our first kills, and that happened to be mine. My company commander personally congratulated me, as he did everyone else in our company. This is the same individual who'd stated that whoever gets their first kill by stabbing them to death will get a 4-day pass when we return from Iraq." And then Hart Vaidya spoke of the 82nd Airborne, part of the invasion force of March 2003. He described a house raid where they arrested the wrong men. Hart said, "We never went on a raid where we got the right house, much less the right person, not once." He said, "I looked at my sergeant. I was like, 'Sergeant, these aren't the men that we're looking for.' And he told me, 'Don't kiss my—' he told me, 'Don't worry. I'm sure they would have done something anyways.'" And Hart said, "This mother all the while is crying in my face, trying to kiss my feet. And, you know, I can't speak Arabic, but I can speak human." She was saying, "Please, why are you taking my sons? They've done nothing wrong." And that made me feel very powerless, Hart said. He said, "You know, here I am, 82nd Airborne Division, infantry, Apache helicopters, Bradley fighting vehicles, armor, and my M4. Yet I was powerless. I was powerless to help this mother." And then there was a young soldier who told a more mundane story, just about an Iraqi man they bagged. Yes, bagged. Threw him in a bag. They knew he was innocent, he said, and they threw him in the truck. And he said his commander then took out a camera and told this young soldier, "Take my picture on him." And there was something in this kid, he said. I don't know if it was his parents' upbringing, his grandparents' influence on him. But he said to his commander, "I can't, sir." He said, "I said, take my picture." And he said, "Sir, I can't." And he was brought up on charges of insubordination for humiliating his commander in front of his unit. And then there were the Lucys. Kevin and Joyce Lucy, they came to speak for Jeffrey. They come from Western Massachusetts. Jeffrey is not included in the more than 4,000 war dead, but he is a casualty of this war. He came back from Iraq in June 2003, and his family was so excited. He was going to live at home, live with his sisters, his parents, be with his girlfriend, go back to college, resume his life, except that he couldn't. He just couldn't focus in college. He started drinking heavily. His parents didn't understand post-traumatic stress. They didn't know what was happening to him. They saw his personality disintegrating. They called the VA. They said they couldn't help unless he dried out, but they said, "That's the problem. He wasn't drinking like this before. Is there any way someone could help?" And then he started to wear his full military regalia, go out in the day and the night, look for any weapon he could find, like a BB gun or something. And then it was June 2004, and Jeffrey asked his dad, oh, his parents had brought him to the VA. They said no. His grandfather took him and said, "Please take him." And they said no. And in June 2004, Jeffrey turned to his dad one night and said, "Could you hold me in your lap?" And his father rocked him silently for 45 minutes. And the next day, Kevin came home from work and called for Jeffrey. He didn't answer, and he saw the basement door open. He went downstairs, and Jeffrey was hanging by a noose. And it was the last time Kevin cradled his son, taking him from the noose. Jeffrey had committed suicide, as hundreds, it may be thousands, have since the beginning. Over the last years, I still have to pin down these numbers because I find it so astounding. But this is a story that has to be told, and it's exactly what Kevin and Joyce are doing through all of their pain. His parents will go anywhere to stop another young soldier, at least make aware to his family that there is hope, that they can find help to stop another suicide. And then there was former Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia. He also spoke. After serving in Iraq, he refused to return. You might know his story, Florida Army National Guardsman. We've had him on Democracy Now! A few times. We wrote about him in a previous book. He was with us on one of our earlier book tours. But Camilo went to Iraq. He came back and on leave and refused to return. He offered to testify before Congress. His unit was in charge of detaining prisoners, and he saw the abuse. And this is before Abu Ghraib. He offered to testify. Instead, he was court-martialed. He was sentenced to a year in prison. He served most of that time. You have to ask, if we lived in a just society, who would be behind bars and who would be free? So at the end of his testimony, Camilo Mejia, who's now chair of Iraq Veterans Against the War, said, "We have over 1 million Iraqi dead. We have over 5 million Iraqis displaced. We have close to 4,000 Americans dead. We have close to 60,000 injured. War is dehumanizing a whole new generation of this country and destroying the people in Iraq. In order for us to reclaim our humanity as a military and as a country, we demand the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all troops from Iraq, care and benefits for all vets, and reparations for the Iraqi people so they can rebuild their country on their own terms. As we enter the 6th year of war in Iraq," hard to believe we've been involved in Iraq longer than the U.S. was involved in World War II. "As we enter the 6th year, we should honor the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. We should honor the people of Iraq and Afghanistan simply by listening to them." And that's what independent media provides, a chance for people to speak for themselves. David told the story of coming into Seattle and riding with the weapons manufacturer. In Albuquerque, we came in from the airport, went through the gate, and there were 40 people waiting, not for us. They were standing with American flags, men, women, children, some in wheelchairs. They were waiting for an officer coming back from tour of duty in Afghanistan, and then a few hours later, a soldier from Iraq. And we went up to the first sergeant, they called her, the head of the welcoming home committee. She was wearing red, white, and blue earrings, a red, white, and blue pin, a red, white, and blue running suit, a red, white, and blue pocketbook. And we asked her what she thought of the war, and she said, "It's terrible." And she said she didn't understand the connection between 9/11 and Iraq. She was also wearing a blue star. Her grandchildren were in the military. And when we asked her why she thought we were fighting this war, she looked around and said quietly, "Oil." And then she went off to have dinner in the airport. She had been at the airport over 300 times so that no one would feel they wouldn't have someone to come home to. And they were waiting for the young man to come back at 6 o'clock in the evening. She said, "He just left in January and he's coming back and it's just April." She said, "He's in terrible shape." She said, "He has post-traumatic stress disorder, as so many of them do," she said. "Don't assume based on what someone looks like or their political affiliation, their race, their ethnicity, their age, how they feel. There is so much unity in this country right now. We just need a media that expresses it and stops cheerleading, if not for war in Iraq, then perhaps for the next war in Iran." It all has to be challenged because it's not just us in public radio and television that are using the public airwaves. NBC, ABC, CBS, they are too. The airwaves are a national treasure. These private corporations like, well, NBC owned by General Electric, right, one of the major weapons manufacturers owning, you know, one of these major networks, they don't own the property, they lease it. And if they don't use it responsibly, they should have their licenses revoked. Now, we also tell the story of the kids, Voices in Conflict. That was the name of their play, Wilton, Connecticut. I don't know what it is in the water in Connecticut, from the librarians to the kids. But, you know, they're doing their high school play. Not a big deal for anyone but the kids in each particular high school when they're doing it and their families. So they decided to do a play dramatizing soldiers' words, writings back home, what soldiers had said about their experiences. They were learning their lines. They were getting their costumes together. And the principal came in and said, "You can do all of that, but you can't perform it on the Wilton High School stage." And they said, "Why not?" He said, "It's too controversial. War, it's too controversial." And the kids were surprised. They argued, they pleaded with him, and he said, "That ship has sailed." And that sailed them right onto the New York stage because theaters in New York heard about the censorship and the public theater and the Culture Project invited them to perform. So here were these kids doing what actors dream of all their lives, performing on the New York stage before hundreds of theatergoers. And what made it so poignant was they were also performing before some of the soldiers whose words they dramatized. We asked the kids if they could talk about war in school. And Jimmy Presson, one of the stars of the play, said they can't. They said they can bring up a current event in their political science class every week, but they're told they can't discuss war. And he said, but then there's Middle East Studies class. And he said, we could talk about it there, but they're not offering it this year. And the final place, they said, so it's drama. That's where they could do it, in drama class. Oh, there was one other place, he said, when the army recruiters come around. When we interviewed the kids at a coffee shop in Wilton, when the parents came to pick them up, they were kvelling. It's a Yiddish term for being very proud. Their heads were swelling with pride. These parents said it was their kids' proudest moment. They taught their kids to respect and obey the principle, but they were abiding by a higher principle. And they said it was their greatest learning moment. They watched their kids grow up before their eyes. When the New York Times did a piece on this, Ira Levin wrote a letter in response that was published. He's the playwright. He's the writer. He just died a few months ago. He wrote The Stepford Wives. He said he grew up in Wilton, Connecticut, and that's what the Stepford Wives was based on. And he congratulated the kids for not being Stepfordized. We also have a chapter, Science Under Siege, on the global warming scientists who have been so remarkable, the dissenters like James Hansen, who we were with on Earth Day in Washington, D.C., who, when he put out reports on global warming being the worst it's ever been, the Bush administration found it was not global warming that was a problem, but James Hansen, and they sicked a political minder on him, a 24-year-old kid who would decide who he would talk to, who the reporters were he would speak to, what kind of information would get out. The kid's only resume qualification, he had been an intern in the war room of the 2004 Bush-Cheney campaign. Well, I won't go on in that chapter, but go on to the next, which is about the psychologist. How many of you are psychologists here? You may know this story. Our chapter is called Psychologists in Denial. How many of you know psychologists? You don't have to answer that. But we write about this debate, and I did a column based on our chapter, A Tortured Debate Among Healers. Imagine a candidate for president who a year or so ago no one would have considered electable. Now the person's the front runner with a groundswell of grassroots support threatening the sense of inevitability of the establishment candidates. I'm not talking about the U.S. presidential race, but the race for president of the largest association of psychologists in the world, the American Psychological Association. At the heart of the election is a raging debate over torture and interrogations. While the other healing professions, including the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, bar their members from participating in interrogations, the APA leadership has fought against such a restriction. It's an astounding story. David and I in Democracy Now! Raced out last summer to San Francisco for the annual convention of the APA. Who would have been thought it would have been so dramatic? After days of late-night negotiations, the moratorium put forward by the dissenters to stop members' participation in coercive interrogations, which is often a euphemism for torture, came up for a climactic vote. We saw a surreal scene on the convention floor. Uniformed military were out in force. Men and women in desert camo and Navy whites worked the APA Council of Representatives. Officers in crisp dress uniforms stepped to the mics. Among those who spoke was Colonel Larry James of the U.S. Army, chief psychologist at Guantanamo Bay. He was flown up to fight the moratorium. He boomed into the mic, "If we remove psychologists from these facilities, people are going to die." Who's in charge? The U.S. government. So the Dallas psychologist, Dr. Lori Wagner, shot back, "If psychologists have to be there in order to keep detainees from being killed, then those conditions are so horrendous, the only moral and ethical thing to do is to protest by leaving." Well, her plea failed. The moratorium failed. It was an astounding moment, but what has come out of that is one of the leading dissenters, a New York psychoanalyst named Dr. Steven Reisner, who actually wept after the moratorium failed and considered leaving the APA, as so many did. After we broadcast the debate, among those who left was, or who gave back her APA presidential citation, was Mary Pfeiffer, the best-selling author of Reviving Ophelia. She said it pained her deeply, but she couldn't be a part of this anymore. Well, Dr. Steven Reisner decided to run for president of the APA. He has just received the most nominating votes of the top five, and the election will take place in October. He is the one who put forward, with a small core, the plea for a moratorium. The election will take place in October, about the same time as our presidential election. The APA and United States will be determining their presidents at about the same time. Let's just hope that torture is a central part of both elections. He's gotten the most nominating votes. It sort of goes to the quote that we have at the beginning of our book, Mahatma Gandhi's: "First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win." I want to end with Rosa Parks. We tell all these modern-day stories and many others. We just don't have time right now to go through it. 2 minutes and I'm done. But then we go through turning points. turning points in history where people have stood up, like the kids in the Soweto uprising in 1976 in South Africa. David and his family lived in South Africa and has done so much work. His previous book is called Fault Lines on South Africa. And we do the piece on Daniel Ellsberg, this remarkable, you know, top Pentagon official, worked for the RAND Corporation, a top security clearance, sees all the protesters outside, and he's standing in front of a vault that's got thousands of pages of the secret history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and he knows if those papers ever get out to the public, it could help end the war in Vietnam, and he's got the key. He knows the combination. And though he faces the rest of his life in prison for treason, he decides to open the vault. He Xeroxes the papers, and they're published in the New York Times. But we start with Rosa Parks. Why Rosa Parks? You all know the story. Why spend more time telling a story true of a remarkable woman? But, well, even with this story, the media has gotten it wrong. Rosa Parks sits down in the bus December 1st, 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, to challenge the segregation and the transportation system of Montgomery. And in so doing, she stands up for not just African Americans, but for all of us, because if any of us is diminished, we're all diminished. That night, her friend, another African American woman, an educator, an activist named Joanne Robinson, mimeographs 35,000 flyers to begin the Montgomery bus boycott. And a few days later, December 5th, 1955, Rosa Parks goes to court. Montgomery Improvement Association has its mass meeting, and they choose as their leader a young minister who's just come into town, the young Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helps to launch Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, a couple years ago when Rosa Parks died, her body, first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda and then brought to a Washington church, Democracy Now! Raced down. Thousands were there inside and outside the church, loudspeakers outside for all to hear. Oprah was there. Cicely Tyson was there. We interviewed a young woman who said she emailed her professors that morning. She was a college student, to say, "I won't be in class today. I'm going to get an education." A 91-year-old woman who is standing off to the side said, "I sat down on the bus 14 years before Rosa in Massachusetts, not the South, but the North. Should I gripped my book acting like I was reading when the driver said, 'Go to the back of the bus.'" And there were other women who sat down on the bus in Montgomery before Rosa. In fact, Rosa sat down in the bus before Rosa sat down on the bus December 1st, 1955. You never know when that magic moment, that turning point, will happen. But that's why it's so important you be involved, that you be involved this year, that you lay the foundation, because when that turning point does happen, you will help determine the course of history. The media got it wrong because they said Rosa Parks was just a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. That's where they got it wrong. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under Edie Nixon. He was president. He came out of radical labor politics. They've been challenging the racist laws for years. She trained at the Highlander Center, black and white together, challenging segregation. She knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on the bus. And this is so important for especially young people to understand. You don't have to do it yourself, that it's movements that change the world. Margaret Mead's quote, "Never doubt for a moment a small group of committed, thoughtful people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." That it's people together, working together, supporting each other. Rosa Parks came out of a movement and she inspired a movement. And to show how brave she was, and this is where we'll end, actually where we were just this morning in Chicago. Emmett Till, 14-year-old African-American boy, from Chicago. His mother sends him to Money, Mississippi for the summer of 1955 to be with family. And he's lynched. He's killed. They said he wolf whistled at a white woman, dragged him out of bed. Not even clear exactly what happened. Even 50 years later, it has not been adequately investigated. But Emmett Till ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. And when his body was sent to Chicago for the wake and funeral, his mother, Mamie Till, said something very brave. She said she wanted his casket open for the wake and funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Thousands streamed by his coffin and saw his distended head. He had been tortured and brutalized. And Jet Magazine and other black publications published the photos. In Detroit, where we just were, an older gentleman came up to me, African-American, white beard, white hair. He said he was 12 years old when his father took him to the funeral, and he will never forget what he saw. Jet Magazine and other black publications published the photos, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if for just 1 week in Iraq, we saw the images of war? We saw the babies dead on the ground, the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs, the soldiers dead and dying. Every day, every night across our TV screens and every front page of every newspaper in this country for just 1 week. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now!
This way. Kathleen.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.